Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Brian Lynn, and Katie Weaver. Later, we will bring you part one of The Law of Life by Jack London in this week's American Stories. But first, here is Pete Musto.
A Ukrainian security researcher has reported finding a database with the information of more than 267 million Facebook users on the open internet, the Associated Press reports. The data includes names, phone numbers, and other identifying information. Nearly all of the users were based in the United States. Bob Diachenko is an independent security researcher in Kyiv. He told the Associated Press, or AP, that criminals likely collected this data. Diachenko said he discovered the database using a search engine. The database was freely accessible on the internet for at least 10 days, beginning on December 4th. He informed the internet provider which hosted the database on December 14th, when he found it. 5 days later, it was no longer available. Diachenko said someone downloaded the database to a special group website 2 days before he discovered it. Hackers, or people who secretly get access to computer systems in order to get information or cause damage, use that website. So the database may have been shared among criminals. Paul Bischoff runs the British technology news website Comparatech. It partnered with Diachenko to report his findings earlier this month. Bischoff has been writing about Diachenko's discoveries of unsecured databases for about a year. The researcher provided the AP with 10 examples from the database. This included unique user identifications, or IDs, and 2 phone numbers that were answered, all of which were linked to real Facebook users. The evidence suggests it was most likely criminals in Vietnam who illegally collected the data. They may have scraped it from public Facebook pages or by somehow getting special, high-level access to the service. Scraping is automated data gathering done by computer programs. A small part of the database includes details on Vietnam-based users. Diachenko said he did not share the database with Facebook, which did not directly confirm the finding. In a statement, representatives for the social media company said it was investigating the issue. They wrote that the finding likely involved information gathered before Facebook took some data protection measures in recent years. The company did not say what those measures were. In 2018, the company stopped permitting users to search for one another using their phone numbers. It did so after news spread that the political agency Cambridge Analytica had accessed information on up to 87 million Facebook users without their knowledge or permission. Diachenko said he had not confirmed when the data was collected. He said all the records appeared to be from January to June of 2019. He added that it was unclear who created them. Security experts say the affected Facebook users are at higher risk of facing password-stealing attacks and identity-stealing attempts. The information can be matched with physical and email addresses and other data collected illegally. Facebook user IDs are unique numbers linked with individual accounts. In September, the news site TechCrunch reported that a researcher found Facebook IDs and phone numbers for more than 400 million users online. In March, Facebook admitted that it had left hundreds of millions of user passwords readable by its employees for years after a security researcher reported on it. I'm Pete Musto.
Scientists are investigating a massive die-off of mussels in a major river in the southeastern United States. They hope to learn the cause. In 2016, fish and wildlife officials discovered a big drop in the mussel population in the Clinch River. The river flows about 480 kilometers through the states of Virginia and Tennessee. It is home to many different kinds of fish and 46 species of mussels. While freshwater mussels are small, they perform some important activities to keep rivers healthy. Mussels can clean up to 38 liters of river water each day, removing algae, metals, and other materials. The process can create a better river environment for fish, amphibians, plants, and insects. For this reason, scientists are working to find the cause of the large drop in mussel populations. Jordan Richard is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He told the Associated Press that officials have estimated that hundreds of thousands, possibly even millions, of mussels have died in the Clinch River. The mass die-off in the river of one kind of mussel, called the pheasant shell, has been especially worrisome. Officials say the population of pheasant shells dropped from 94,000 in 2016 to less than 14,000 in 2019. They measured the decrease along a 200-meter stretch of the Clinch River. Similar die-offs have been reported on at least five U.S. rivers and another in Spain. Richard has studied reports of similar die-offs over the years in rivers around the world. But so far, he has not come up with many answers about why they happened. Speaking about the Clinch, Richard said the river could even be compared to the Amazon because it contains so many different kinds of life. He spoke to the AP while examining the river's mussel population in a rural community in Tennessee. Mussel populations around the world have dropped sharply over the past 100 years. Scientists blame this on pollution, habitat loss, and climate change. But they suspect the most recent decreases have another cause. Richard and his team believe an infectious disease could be responsible. The team is comparing healthy pheasant shell mussels to dying ones in an attempt to narrow down a list of possible diseases. All living things are chock full of microorganisms, and we don't have any sort of map for what is healthy inside a muscle, Richard said. University of Wisconsin disease specialist Tony Goldberg is helping with the investigation. He specializes in wildlife illnesses of unknown cause. Goldberg told the AP that often disease is the final thing to kill a species that has already been harmed by other environmental conditions. However, he says he is hopeful that the freshwater mussel team will be able to discover the cause of the massive die-offs and find a way to prevent them. The team includes scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey and a nonprofit conservation group. I see it as a race against time, not an impossible task, Goldberg said, adding, if we lose these mussels, the rivers we all love are never going to be the same. I'm Brian Lynn.
The remains of artwork found at what was once the largest city in the Americas has added to evidence that even commoners who lived there enjoyed the finer things in life. Each year, millions of travelers visit the huge pyramids and other structures that made up the city of Teotihuacan, about 48 kilometers north of present-day Mexico City. The newly discovered art was found on the city's southern edge, far from the center, and far from where visitors explore today. Boston University scientist David Carballo discovered the art. The large, brightly colored pictures, or murals, were painted on three buildings he began excavating in July. He said, "We're now finding that life on the periphery was pretty good." The paintings show flowers and singing birds. Carballo said it was surprising to find such works so far away from Teotihuacan's center. Carballo and his team have also found other signs of wealth nearby, including a stone mask, seashells from Mexico's Pacific and Gulf coasts, and jadestone. The mural discoveries point to a very different path taken by Teotihuacan compared to other ancient civilizations. The city was most successful from about 100 BC to 550 AD. At the time, daily life in Mayan cities, ancient Rome, and ancient Egypt was marked by a small, powerful group of people controlling poor or enslaved masses. But in Teotihuacan's case, most of its estimated 100,000 people were treated well. Scientists believe that a successful craft-based economy made the city rich. Near the murals, Carballo and his team unearthed what would have been a busy workshop. Workers there likely produced some 200,000 sharp tools made of volcanic glass. In an area of the city called La Ventilla, another part of Teotihuacan equality can be observed. multifamily stone housing centers, where over 90% of the city's people lived. Teotihuacan has more than 2,000 such centers. The narrow streets of these centers of housing suggest a dense city existence. The centers had water removal systems, open air spaces, and murals. Ruben Cabrera is an archaeologist who has long led excavations at La Ventilla. He said Teotihuacan's mass housing is not found elsewhere in ancient times. He said it shows there was less inequality in the city than in most other places. It wasn't as pronounced as, say, Rome or other places where there was a dominant group and a dominated group, he said. No evidence of slavery has been found in more than 100 years of digs there, he noted. Arizona State University archaeologist Michael Smith leads a research laboratory at Teotihuacan. He measured wealth of the city based on its home sizes. The measurement is called a Gini score. A 1.0 measure means a single household owns everything, and zero represents total equality. Teotihuacan's Gini score came in at 0.12. Smith said that shows an extremely low level of inequality for a pre-industrial society. I'm Katie Weaver.
The Law of Life by Jack London. Part 1.
Old Kashkus listened greedily. Although his sight had failed, his hearing remained good. The slightest sound was recognized by a mind yet active behind the aged forehead. Ah, that was Sitkumha, shouting curses at the dogs as she beat them into the harnesses. Sitkumha was his daughter's daughter, but she was too busy to waste a thought upon her old grandfather, sitting alone there in the snow. Camp must be broken. The long trail waited while the short day refused to delay. Life called her, and the duties of life, not death. And he was very close to death now. The thought frightened the old man for a moment. He stretched forth a shaking hand, which wandered over the small pile of dried wood beside him. Reassured that it was there, his hand returned to the shelter of his old, worn furs. He again began to listen. He heard the noise of the half-frozen animal skins being moved. He knew that even then the chief's moose-skin tent was being packed. The chief was his son, leader of the tribesmen, and a mighty hunter. As the women worked, his voice rose, exclaiming at their slowness. Old Kaskush strained his ears. It was the last time he would hear that voice. There went Greenhouse Tent and Tuskins. 7, 8, 9. Only the medicine man's could yet be standing. There, they were at work upon it now. He could hear the medicine man struggling loudly as he piled it on the sled. A child cried, and a woman calmed it with gentle singing. Little Cootie, the old man thought. That child was always weeping and it was sickly. It would die soon, perhaps, and they would burn a hole through the frozen ground and pile rocks above to keep the wolves away. And what difference would it make? A few years at best, and as many an empty stomach as a full one, and in the end, death waited, ever hungry and hungriest of them all. What was that? Ah, the men binding the sleds together and drawing tight the ropes. He listened, he who would listen no more. The whips whistled among the dogs. Hear them howl! How they hated the work and the trail through the snow. It started. Sled after sled moved slowly away into the silent forest. And they were gone. They had passed out of his life, and he faced the last bitter hour alone. No. The step of a moccasin broke the snow's surface. A man stood beside him. Upon his head a hand rested gently. His son was good to do this thing. He remembered other old men whose sons had not waited after the tribe had gone. But his son had. The old man's thoughts wandered away into the past, until the young man's voice returned him to the present. "It is well with you," he asked. The old man answered, "It is well." "There is wood beside you," the younger man continued, "and the fire burns bright. The morning is gray, and the cold has lessened. It will snow presently. Even now it is snowing."
"Yes, even now it is snowing."
"The tribesmen hurry. Their loads are heavy and their stomachs empty with lack of feasting. The trail ahead is long, and they travel fast. I go now. Is it well?"
"It is well. I am as a last year's leaf hanging lightly on a branch. When the first wind blows, I fall. My voice has become like an old woman's. My eyes no longer show me the way of my feet, and my feet are heavy, and I am tired. It is well."
He bowed his head in contentment until the last noise of the moccasin on the snow died away. He knew his son was beyond recall. Then his hand moved out from the firs to touch the wood. It alone stood between him and what lay beyond the death that opened before him. Now the measure of his life was a handful of sticks. One by one they would go to feed the fire. And just so, step by step, death would come closer to him. When the last stick had given all of its heat, the frost would begin to gather strength. First his feet would yield, then his hands, and the lack of feeling would travel slowly to his body. His head would fall forward upon his knees, and he would rest. It was easy. All men must die. He did not murmur. It was the law of life, and it was just. He had been born close to the earth, and close to the earth had he lived. Its law was not new to him. It was the law of all flesh. Nature was not kindly to the flesh. She had no concern for that single thing called the individual. Her interest lay in the race of man as a whole.
He grasped this idea firmly. He saw its truth displayed everywhere. The awakening of life in a tree, the bursting greenness of its branches, the fall of the yellow leaf. In this alone was told the whole history. But one task nature did give the individual. Did he not perform it, he died. Did he perform it, it was all the same, he died. Nature did not care. There were plenty who would obey. It was only the need that this duty be obeyed, not the man who obeyed it, which lived and lived always. The tribe of Kashkush was very old. The old men he had known when he was a boy had known old men before them. Therefore it was true that the tribe lived, that it represented the obeying of all its members, whose final resting places were unremembered. They were not important. They were chapters in life's story. They had passed away like clouds from a summer sky. He also would pass away. Nature did not care. To life she gave one task and one law. To continue the race was the task of life. Its law was death. A young girl was a good creature to look upon, full-breasted and strong, with a lightness to her step and a shine in her eyes. But her task was yet before her. The light in her eyes brightened and her step quickened. She laughed with the young men, then she turned away. She passed on to them her own unrest, and she grew fairer and yet fairer to look upon. Finally, some hunter took her to his tent to cook and work for him, and to become the mother of his children. And with the coming of her children, her beauty left her. She dragged her legs and arms when she walked. Her eyes lost their brightness. Then only the little ones found joy in the old lined face. Her task was done. In a little while, in the first famine or in the first long trail, she would be left, as he had been left in the snow, with a little pile of wood. Such is the law. He placed a stick carefully on the fire and returned to his thoughts. It was the same everywhere, with all things. The insects disappeared with the first frost. When age settled upon the rabbit, it became slow and heavy and could no longer run faster than its enemies. Even the big bear grew old and blind, to be dragged down at last by a small group of barking sled dogs. He remembered how he had left his own father along the Klondike River one winter. It was the winter before the missionary came with his books and his box of medicines. Many times Kashkush had recalled with pleasure the taste of those medicines. The one called painkiller was especially good. But now his mouth refused to moisten. He remembered that the missionary had become a worry to them. He brought no meat into the camp, and he ate much. The hunters did not like this. Then, when they were near the Mayo, he became ill, and afterward the dogs pushed the stones away and fought for his bones.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.